and welcome. I'm Roger P. Shulman. Today we're talking to Julie Clark Ames. She's the author of a very excellent book called A Very Special Journey of Grief, Grace, and Gratitude, and subtitle, No, They Are Not Okay, But It's Okay, Raising Special Needs Kids. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Roger. How are you doing today?
Glorious. And you're a very familiar face and voice at our radio station. You've had a program here for several years that was quite informative. Tell us about that and how you got involved in writing a book.
Well, the way it all began was I realized that my children had special needs when they were almost 7, 5, and the youngest was 3. The oldest 2 are on the autism spectrum and have intellectual disabilities. And at the time, I discovered that my oldest 2 children have challenges. I started writing to cope with what I was dealing with. So originally, I was told at that point in time that I had a genetic anomaly. My chromosomes, the tip of chromosome 3 and 5 were switched. So it meant I could have a typical child like my youngest, Anna, or it meant I could have a child, children like Maria and Christina, who have intellectual disabilities and are on the autism spectrum. Mentally, they're kindergarten to second grade. Or it meant I could have a baby known as a Croix de Chaw baby. It means cats cry in French.
Well, for a very distinctive sound they make, I understand.
Yes, it sounds like a cat crying. And the babies usually don't live very long. I mean, they live longer than they used to. But so I had all this news. And when I got it, I didn't realize I was expecting baby number 4. So during this time period, I'm dealing with a realization that I have 2 children who, at that point, all I knew is that they were going to be probably, the geneticist said they're going to be slower, not as smart, and shorter than other kids, generally, when there's a genetic anomaly. And that's really all I knew. And then I didn't know I could have this baby that had a Croix de Chaw syndrome. Well, anyway, in a couple weeks, I find out I'm expecting baby number 4. I lost baby number 4 at 4 months. So during this time period, I am dealing with all my grief. And after I slowly got through all of that, part of my grieving process was writing. So I started writing about the different experiences that I was going through because there really was no book to help guide me around along the way. And in my children's, it wasn't as if they had a syndrome. They're the only kids or people like themselves. So it wasn't as if I knew that they had Down syndrome and I could pick up a book about Down syndrome and kind of have an idea of how long they would live, what to expect. So I really had no idea what the future would hold. So as I started writing about my feelings and what I was going through, I always wrote with the intent of making it a book one day. And I finally did. And I completed the book. Oh, what year was that? I completed the book 2014. And it was about that time that the opportunity came up to have a radio show. So what's interesting about that is I'd always planned to publish the book, and I was going to have a website and start doing podcasts. So this was 2014. I was planning to have people over to my house, educators, doctors, and discuss different things related to special needs. And my goal was to have podcasts on a website that were free. And then the opportunity came up to have the radio show. And so that delayed publishing the book. I am so glad that I published the book later. So I published the book early 2020. And because of COVID, really did not have an opportunity to promote it like you normally would promote a book.
Right.
But the opportunity to have the radio show, it was everything that I had hoped to have, but it was all professionally done. So all the podcasts are professionally produced. I had amazing guests on the show. And as a result, I have a library that parents can go in and type in any topic that they want information on. And my goal is always to educate and help people. So I hope that when a person needs help with a certain subject, they can click on that topic and they can look at it. And I always provide links and other information so that they can get even more in-depth information on a particular topic.
So what is your website? How can they access your information?
SpecialNeedsFamilyHour.com.
SpecialNeedsFamilyHour.com. I found your book very interesting because it would be valuable not only to someone with special needs children. Anyone with children can benefit from your unique knowledge of navigating the education system, which is remarkable for things like matrices and other words that normal parents wouldn't know to deal with, points of access, how to get things done, and the medical system. Also, you went to dozens of specialists before you even knew you had special needs children, which I found amazing.
Yes, that was kind of a shocker. The first clue that I might have a problem, Maria was 5 and she didn't grow that year. So I went to see an endocrinologist. But the amazing thing about my children is all along the way, for instance, they both are what we call tactile defensive. So it took me forever to get them to learn to brush their teeth, for them to go barefoot, to be able to walk outside. One still doesn't like sand. But my biggest sensory battle with my children was for Maria and Christina to learn to eat. And I was always up front with the doctors that the girls only ate soft food.
And that tongue thrusting syndrome.
Yes. And so when Maria, I had never been around kids and I didn't realize when the doctor asked me, are you feeding her? I'm like, yes, I spent hours trying to feed her. I didn't realize that she was tongue thrusting and wasn't putting the food in. And it would just be a mess. But I just assume, right? All babies are messy. So I was really annoyed when he asked me that. And I did not get help for their feeding until they were 11 and 13 years old.
That's amazing that the medical profession failed you so profoundly with so many specialists that you visited about your two daughters.
Well, I'm not going to use names, but I went to a very elite institution in Washington, D.C. And I actually did a evaluation of Maria when she was about 3. And they did their complete evaluation and a geneticist signed off on the report. And no genetics was ever done. And that would have at least been a clue.
So that chromosomal translocation, if I have that right, was not discovered
yes.
at that point.
No, it wouldn't be discovered until, 4 years later?
Good heavens.
So then I even took Maria to a nutritionist at another well-known hospital in Washington, D.C., and she told me that she couldn't help me, that the only people that she knew could help me were on the West Coast. I believe they were in Arizona, and they did a lot of food play. I guess putting food on the kid's face. So she told me, she said, well, theoretically, you know, Maria can drink shakes. Her diet is healthy. But she says, I don't know anyone that can help you. Technically, there was a group that could have helped me on the East Coast at that time. And then that's Maria when she's 4. Then I go for an eating evaluation when she's a little bit older at another well-known hospital in Northern Virginia. And the woman watches her eat her food. Well, yes, Maria can eat yogurt. She could eat her soft foods. She just didn't know how to chew.
How old was Maria at that point?
Maria was about 5.
when kids normally can chew. So that's...
Yes. So neither of them, by the time I had Anna, see, my goal with each child was that, all right, so I had Maria, she wouldn't chew food. So I thought, well, when I had the next baby, 2 years later, I had Christina. I thought, well, Christina will eat and Maria will see Christina chew food. And then Christina didn't eat. And then little Anna was born. So Maria was 5, Christina was 3. And then I had Anna, and Anna would eat. She would eat Cheerios. She would eat everything, and they would just look at her. And I can't tell you, I was so, so embarrassed. Maria and Christina weren't potty trained until they were about 7 and 5. It was right before turning 7 and 5. And I was always hiding that. I was hiding the fact that they didn't chew their food. I felt like a complete failure, right? I'm an industrial engineer, and I can't teach my kids how to be potty trained. I can't teach them to eat.
That's right. You were working on aircraft carriers in Washington, D.C. You met your husband, Jeff, up there, who was in the Army. And
yes.
And between the two of you, you had a situation that even the professionals couldn't even help you with.
Yeah, so I was just floundering. And truthfully, it was actually a relief to realize that I had a genetic anomaly, because at least I had a reason why I couldn't teach them very basic concepts. Because at that time, I was homeschooling them because I knew Maria wasn't ready for school. And I would literally sit down and I would line up the characters, right? The firemen. And 3 little characters. And I would say, well, who's in the front of the line? Who's in the back of the line? And they couldn't tell me. Or I would hold a ball above my head, below my chair. I would say, is it above or below or on my lap? And they couldn't tell me. But they really weren't ready for that concept for a few years.
And you tried to put them in school, and the education system was quite a strange experience, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. It was originally I had Maria and Christina seeing a speech therapist. And truly, Christina originally started seeing a speech therapist in our home in Virginia. And that was not a problem. But then we started her in speech therapy about 6 months after we moved to Florida in March. And the speech therapist, it did not go well with Christina. It was during that period that she started hyperventilating and she wouldn't stop. And I literally, this was also the same time I was expecting baby number 4. It was just a horrible time. And she started hyperventilating. And the doctor, when he first met her, when the neurologist first met her, thought she had Rett syndrome, which is a degenerative nerve disease that eventually will kill you. So it was a horrible time. And then the speech therapist suggested that Maria and Christina try school, that there was a wonderful program for Christina for kids before they entered kindergarten. And by this time, Christina was already 5. So that sounded good to me. And so we tried Maria and Christina at school that spring. Christina was so, oh my gosh, she was always calling for me, like when I'm mom, mom, mom. And I did not realize Christina needed to be home with me. And my husband and I both finally realized that. And then Maria, that spring went okay, but they said that Maria needed to be in kindergarten. So that was fine. So Maria was back in kindergarten and everything was okay. I met the teacher. She was excited when I told her, yes, I'd love to be the homeroom mom. And then next thing I know, I'm not the homeroom mom.
And from that, you figured out that perhaps she wasn't doing as well as expected in kindergarten.
Exactly. It was just, yeah. Oh, I was so sad. It was like, oh my goodness. And then eventually she told me that this was working out and that Maria was very, very lucky that everyone, that this was a nice class. This woman, she was wonderful. She had been teaching for over 30 years. And she told me, she said, "Miss Ames, this is the nicest class I've ever had. And everyone has been nice to your daughter. But your daughter does not, she belongs in a special class." So that was my first clue for sure about Maria. In the meantime, we had already started the process with Christina. They had already done the psychological testing, figuring out where Christina was, and academically, intellectually, which those things at that age are, they can change a little bit. So we were already looking at different classrooms, different places. And first thing I know is we met with them before school let out that spring, right after Christina had started. And they were going to have Christina go to some program 30 minutes away on a bus.
Good heavens.
Yes. And she's just had anxiety. So that fall, we said no, we couldn't. That we wanted to look at other options, and we did. But during that period, we visited three classrooms, and Christina started stuttering. So she would say, "Ma, ma, ma, da, da, da," and she started stuttering. She was so stressed out. And my husband looked at me, and he said, "If we continue in this, if she gets a stuttering problem," he says, "I don't know what we'll do between the hyperventilating and the stuttering." So the minute we told her she didn't have to go to school, the stuttering stopped.
So you delayed things and homeschooled her for a while and
for another year. And she stayed home with Anna. And Anna was a very advanced little girl. So it was wonderful. It was wonderful for her just to be there with Anna.
And one thing for any parent, special needs or not, is you advise in your book, get to know the teachers, become intimately involved in the school, observe how they interact with the students. That's really important. Talk to other
yes.
parents, and don't be afraid to make discerning decisions based on any of the factors you see firsthand. The schools will usually work with you. Not always, but they usually
no.
will. There are some really great teachers out there, and there's some really not so great administrators and teachers you've found.
Right. Well, we had a school psychologist that was determined that she could fix Christina's hyperventilating problem.
Oh, yes, and that one.
Yes. And we knew she wasn't going to be able to fix it. All right. Christina at this point already had a psychiatrist.
You had a method of stopping her hyperventilation, didn't you? You had a special method that actually worked.
Yes, when she was little, you could actually come up behind her and scrunch her, like just, you know, just hug her from behind.
Distract
and then
her,
she, yeah, and then she couldn't take those deep breaths because she was leaned over, and that would work. The other thing is just taking whatever she was doing, if she was eating, if she was playing, writing, just take something away and ask her to count to 10. So we had different things. So when she would do that and she could stop hyperventilating, then she could sit down again. But we really ended up in a terrible situation because the teacher that she had during this time period, she was only a teacher so she could be there to take care of her granddaughter. She had really been a lawyer and retired. And she was not physically able to help Christina.
Was she the one who needed the scooter to get around? Or
yes.
Wasn't capable of actually getting up and taking care of things?
Yes. So, of course, if you don't stop Christina from hyperventilating, it's awful, right? You lose your carbon dioxide buildup, you start stumbling around, falling. So it's one of those activities that until she could reach the point where she could realize cause and effect, and that didn't happen until she was probably high school. I can remember in the kitchen telling me, "I don't feel good. I have a headache because of my huffing." We called it huffing. And But before she could do that, that meant that everyone in her life had to control that behavior.
And the psychologist that was involved threatened to bring in DCF over her breathing problems.
Yes. So the psychologist, she called me early that, like September, October, and told me that she would like access to the doctors or something. All I know is I actually got a facial. I had a twitch right under my eye, a little twitch from that conversation. And
it affected you that badly. That's
yes,
terrible.
There was something not right about it. And then a month or two later, she calls me and she tells me if I do not sign a release for her to talk to every single one of Christina's doctors, that she is going to call DCF or CPI. And so I signed everything. But during that time period, I mean, I could go back and look it up, but during that time period in Florida, DCF was, I mean, they were just taking kids. They weren't asking questions. They were just taking them. And I knew that if Christina was taken from me, gosh, I said I wasn't going to get emotional, but I mean, if she was taken from me, she would not have done well. She was so sick and she was so thin. And during this time period, she had developed her seizure disorder. So the summer before the psychologist had worked with her that spring. That summer, Christina goes to the hospital with her seizure disorder. We're in St. Joseph's for 3 days. And we don't do anything for the next 6 weeks. Then she goes to school, and this psychologist is threatening me with DCF. And
now,
Christina
let's tell parents what you did and what you could have done to prevent this. You did have some, once you checked with a lawyer, you did have some things you could have done, like bringing in a lawyer very early in this activity.
Yes. So my goal with my book is to write things in such a way that parents will know what to do if the situation happens to them. So
mention your book again, A Very Special Journey of Grief, Grace, and Gratitude by Julie Clark Ames. And this outlines so many things that parents with special needs kids and non-special needs kids could definitely use the DCF, how to handle them and not get caught up in their web of sometimes deception, how to deal with the medical world and how to deal with the school system, of course. So go ahead. Let me.
Yes. Well, with the school system and the psychologist, if I had with a teacher, I feel like maybe I should have gotten in there earlier with the teacher and specifically gone over Christina's challenges.
Right.
Specifically, but I don't know that would have helped because physically she wasn't able to stop it. And yes, it's important that all special needs parents have a lawyer or know who they're going to call in a situation. So when she threatened me, I actually read the language for, I'm going blank. I actually read the law reference special needs and fair and appropriate education. And I couldn't make heads or tails all out of it. So basically,
you're an engineer, your husband, an army officer, you're sophisticated, college educated people. And this was totally gobbledygook.
Yes. And I knew, I felt like my rights had been violated, but like all things is yes, something can be written into law, but then it's how it's interpreted. So I called an education lawyer and he told me my rights were violated, that no one can force a parent to sign a document. And he said, this is what you need to do. So we wrote a very professional letter. I always say everyone needs their own, you need your own counsel, but you're free to copy what I did, that type of thing. But I wanted the school to, I wanted the psychologist to leave Christina alone. I told the school that they were not responsible, that her father and I would handle it. She was in, she had her own psychiatrist who was in charge of her well-being. So that is what I did to stop this whole situation. And it stopped. We put Christina in a different class where she did have the help and people who could stop her and enforce the right behaviors. The other challenge with the class she had been in, with a teacher who couldn't stop her behaviors, is that class was supposed to be special needs, and it had become an academic support class. So basically, any child that was having trouble with reading would come in during the reading session. Any child having trouble with math would come in during the math lesson. And my children, and a lot of children on the autism spectrum, cannot handle change.
No, they like so structure. They like it the same every
yes.
day, don't they?
So you constantly had this disruption in the classroom that they were both in. And Maria, it was the worst year Maria had in school. So the whole situation was not good. The next year, Christina immediately got into a different class. And fortunately, the next year, Maria also had a different teacher.
You learned a lot about education, the curse of the Minimo device. They tried to force a device on, which was
yes,
it?
Christina. Because Christina couldn't talk, she had very limited vocabulary, so she economized her words. So she would basically, if she needed something, get it. Very simple words. At the time, if she said hello to you, as it was hello. And thank you was kenku. So she minimized the letters she could say, and it was very difficult to understand her. So the Minimo device was a device where you just press a picture, and it would ask, like, you. So what I do is she would raise her hand, press the button, and it would say, may I go to the bathroom? Well, originally we had agreed to the Minimo. It was in June at the end of one school year. That summer, Christina's language blossomed. And at the beginning of the year, she had a new teacher, and we discussed that we did not want to go through with a Minimo. And the Minimo was, I'm sure that now they have other devices. But basically, there's lots of devices that have different names where a child can communicate through technology. And the teacher agreed with us, but we had a speech therapist that was determined to use the Minimo. And I always felt like she was padding her resume because it was a new piece of technology. And before we knew it, she was off to a private fancy speech therapy group.
Interesting how that happened.
Yes. But fortunately, so we only had to deal with it for a few months. And the teacher agreed with us completely that it was decreasing Christina's speech ability and slowing her down.
Yeah, she could just press a button. Why talk? You know, it's
exactly.
So, special education is a world of its own in education. It has its own technology. It has its own terminology. It has its own specialists, and they have a thing called the Matrix, which I found fascinating in your book that I knew nothing about.
Well, neither did I. I had no idea, and I'd been going to these IEP meetings. I didn't realize it until the kids had been in special ed for a few years. Apparently, after the IEP meeting, all
what
the people
IEP
there...
What does IEP stand for?
Oh, Individual Education Plan.
Okay, go ahead.
So your Individual Education Plan outlines all the child's goals. It could be, you know, academic, socially. It outlines their goals, and then you meet and discuss it, and everyone agrees to it, sign the papers. So the parents go to that meeting. After that meeting, everybody stays there, and they just... Except the parents, yes, and you don't realize that, but everyone else is having another meeting discussing the Matrix, and the Matrix is how they determine funding. So how much money a school will get for your child based on the number they give them for the Matrix. And it was the most bizarre thing because I didn't find out about the Matrix until that awful year that I had with the girls because I was looking at a private school. And the private schools, because of the McKay scholarships in Florida, you can take public money and use it for that would have gone to a school and use it for private education.
So the public schools don't like that very much, I'm sure.
No, no. And you can use that, but the private school has to know what the matrix is number, so you know how much you have to make up in tuition. And that was the first time I found out about it. And then I was surprised because Maria had a higher matrix than Christina, and Christina was the one that needed all the support. So that surprised me. But it's interesting because originally they were so secretive about the matrix, but now Hillsborough County, through the Fiddlers, the Florida, their parent organization that helps, they do, the Hillsborough County has done matrix trainings for parents. So it's different. But back then it was very hush hush.
Getting back to your two daughters with the special needs, you would go out in public and it was very difficult at times because people... You felt you were being judged sometimes by the conduct of your daughters or the difficulties they had. But it seems that so many people now have special needs children in their families or know of families with that, that people are a lot more friendly, open, and tolerant about behavior that perhaps would have gotten a parent embarrassed maybe just a few years ago.
Yes, I think that's so true. And yeah, things are very, I think they're very different. Once in a while, like I still take the girls to the playground. And it's interesting because some people are more open than others.
Right.
And, but most of the people, I would say 90% of the people I run into are very friendly and very comfortable.
And if a child has a meltdown, they accept that now because they know that a lot of kids have these situations and a lot of parents have these situations. And I think that it's become much more open and accepted, if you will, that these things are going to happen.
Yes, that doesn't mean it's not still embarrassing.
Of course.
Because, and the challenge too, it's just like my kids. I can remember my husband asking me, is it a discipline problem or a training problem? In other words, is it, you know, are they just being bad or have I not trained them properly?
Sounds like an army man.
Yes. I mean, yes, sir, no, sir, I don't know, sir. Those were the three answers he would have preferred.
We had this was an adult, a young man who was working as a very good mechanic in a garage, and one of the owners told me, I don't know if we can keep him. He has these blow-ups. And I said, people accept that now.
Yes.
He has his blow-ups. He cusses a little bit and throws a few tools around. Then he gets back to work and he's fine. I mean, he had some difficulties in his childhood and he's adapted to them. But occasionally something happens. I said, you know, people aren't going to say much because they probably have a similar situation in their family.
Yes. Well, right now the statistics is I believe it's 1 in 44 now. Families are affected with a child with autism.
I think it's more than that, actually. It seems to be because so many people I know and some folks in my family have different manifestations. And I think people are becoming a lot more open and accepting of things that perhaps a few years ago they would have pointed and said, oh, my goodness. Now they're saying, ah, well, happens in my family, too. So I think that's a good thing that people are nicer, I think. And another thing,
yes.
You can be driving down the road and people are not nice in this scenario driving. Let's say you're a cancer patient and you become nauseous and vomit and have to pull over, or your child has an explosion or some sort of hyperventilation or something where you need to immediately. People are not very accepting of driving. That's one area that they are not very nice.
Yes, that's true. Very true. And we've had to pull off the road many, many times.
And it's difficult. And I feel very badly for people in that situation. Another piece of advice you gave, which I thought was very interesting, is if you are going to take your children to the doctor, look professional in a medical setting. Don't come all frumped. Because if you're one professional talking to another, makes a better impression and perhaps gets better results.
Yes, I don't feel like I have to wear my business suits, but yes, I always want the kids. This is the time that we want the children to look clean. We want to be as presentable as possible. I always have a notebook or something I can write on. I will have questions listed ahead of time so I don't forget something. And so it's a productive meeting. And I always, especially when the kids were younger, I always had a grab bag of activities, whether it was coloring or drawing, that they could do to keep themselves occupied. But yes.
Go ahead.
Well, with doctors, I can remember reading about business in general is conducted in a upper middle class way. And so my thoughts on that is you just need to be presentable and put your best foot forward.
Not necessarily in an emergency room situation with an ambulance, but yes.
No, I don't always look. Things usually are very distressed in the ambulance. Oh, my gosh.
And you've had a few of those incidents. And the nice thing about an ambulance is you get in right away, don't you?
Yes. The ambulance, you know, all those people that, and even elderly people are always reluctant to call the ambulance, and it's embarrassing. Hey, if you take the ambulance in there, you're at the front of the line. When I'm calling an ambulance, though, I mean, it's because I can't stop her seizures, and it is an emergency, and I need the tools that they have on the ambulance because I can't give her any more medication because it would cause respiratory failure.
Let's talk about that medication. Very expensive medications that have to be given in suppository form, aren't they?
Yes. The good news is just this past year, they've come out with a new way to deliver the medication through, it's called Valtaco. And I am able to give Christina medicine in her nose.
Well, thank God for that.
So, Yes. Because, you know, over the years, getting a babysitter and explaining what they have to do if Christina has a major seizure and it's not stopping, it's one thing for someone to kind of understand that. But I'm always looking at them, trying to figure out if I think they can really handle it.
This is not a compliant patient either. It's somebody actually having an active seizure.
No, I mean, when she's having a major seizure, I mean, you're physically grabbing her, putting her in the right position. It's a very physical thing. So the good news is they do have Valtaco. Over the years, it has been amazing how much medicine can cost.
Oh my goodness, yes.
Yeah, I mean, $1,000 a month easily. She was just on a medication. Thankfully, it didn't agree, but it was so expensive. Oh, my gosh. And just so people, if anyone's listening, you can go to a manufacturer's website. They will have discounts there. There are things you can do.
That's very important. Talking to Julie Clark Ames, the author of A Very Special Journey of Grief, Grace, and Gratitude. Where is your book available?
It's available on Amazon, Barnes & Nobles.
And this book, reading, and when I first read it, I thought it was going to be just for special needs families. This is a valuable resource to any family that has kids that you take to the doctor or are in education or anything else, really. This is a tremendous guidebook. Your experiences are tremendously valuable. You and your husband are very religious people, aren't you?
Oh, very, very, very religious. And that informs our life and how we've handled this. Oftentimes you know how you have those intellectual conversation, fate, chance, destiny, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. My outlook is life is a gift and all life is a gift. And
I remember your husband said something to you that I wouldn't trade them for anything.
Yes, because I kept looking. I kept looking at the other kids. The worst was Sunday. Okay, Sunday after church. We would go to coffee and donuts, and all these little girls, I don't know if they were daisies or brownies, they would come in and they looked so cute in the little uniforms. And I can remember looking over at them, telling my husband, look at them. And in my voice, he could hear my longing and, in a way, maybe my judgment that my own Maria wasn't like them. And he looked at me and he said, don't rob me of my joy.
Mm.
And I had not realized that by comparing my child and not accepting them for the gift that they were and who they were, I was taking away not only his joy, but my joy. And I can remember one day they were playing outside together and he looked at them and he laughed and he says, I wouldn't trade them for any other kids in the world.
And your priest said something about carrying crosses, and it's common to look around and think that someone else's problems are easier or less than your own, or they're given more things, and it's impacted you and helped you to let go of your sense of loss, accepting that raising two special needs daughters is part of your role and your journey through life. And we need to pray unconditionally for unconditional love and the strength to do what needs to be done. And you've had enormous strength given to you.
Well, yes, but that comes back to praying and asking for unconditional love, because, I mean, there are times you'll look at a child and they'll have a trait that you recognize as a family trait of someone that you're not fond of, and you'll think, oh, my goodness. And I always pray for unconditional love, and just that longing for it, it comes. It almost comes immediately, and that has helped greatly. And the cross, There's such a truth to that. I mean, you think about carrying a cross is, I'm comfortable with my cross. I look at other people's lives and I would not be comfortable with what they're dealing with. And no, I mean, I look at God sometimes. I think, really? I'm an engineer. I should have been an educator. Or if I was going to write a book, I should have been a writer. You know,
well, you are all those things now, and you've gotten another degree, haven't you?
Yes, I got my master's in counseling. And the way that happened is my dad's wife suggested that I look into counseling. All the people I had on my show, they were educators, counselors, social workers, doctors. And I started taking counseling classes and I loved them. And it added another level of understanding to the various topics, whether it was family, social, education. And so I have my master's in counseling and I'm a licensed professional counselor associate.
How are your daughters doing now?
They're doing great. Maria is 26. Christina is 24. They participate in a day program. And my youngest daughter, she's 21. She graduated in entertainment management from University of Central Florida. And she's currently working in Texas, and her first job, and things are going well for her. And we haven't talked much about her, but she's in the book. She always was a special little girl that it was amazing the way she was able to handle her sisters and handle things. At times she was discriminated against. I always thought there would be the other two discriminated against, but sometimes a babysitter might discriminate against Anna because they're more concerned about the other two or whatever. So, but Anna has handled things, and I can remember the kids next door talking to Anna about saying something about that her sisters are weird, and she looked at him, she says, well, they're special needs, and walked off. So it's been a journey for all of us.
Is there anything I didn't cover that you'd like to talk about? Any area that I didn't have the intelligence to ask about?
No, it's just about doctors. When it comes to doctors, we talked about that, but there's something about intuition or just knowing that something's not right.
Follow the guts, yes.
Yes, well, when I first moved to Florida, my realtor told me about this wonderful doctor. She said, he's the only doctor that will see all five of my kids at the same time. And she was thrilled with him. She told me how he would take mission trips and help kids in other parts of the world. So I went to the office with all my files, and I was there. I can remember it was lunchtime. The staff was, I remember one of the staff exercising, and something just, I don't know, something didn't seem right. I went back later and got my files and found a different doctor. And it turned out that he actually had, I don't know, a substance use problem. And all those times he was supposed to be somewhere helping people, he was in rehab.
Oh, my goodness.
So the point, though, is listen to your intuition. My husband and I have both said, if we ever take the children in for surgery or ourselves, if something does not seem right, we will listen to that and will not do the surgery. That has never happened. We also have that agreement about plane flights. That has never happened. But there's that sixth sense that I think God gives us, right? The idea that you can see a driver across the way and you intuitively know what they're going to do. Mm-hmm. It's because you're picking up on different body languages that they're, or different vibes that they're putting off.
Or perhaps something we don't even know about. Yes, it's amazing.
Exactly. Yes. Well, yes. So
how do we access your information? You have a podcast, you have the book. Let's start with the book. The book is available at Amazon, A Very Special Journey of Grief, Grace, and Gratitude by Julie Clark Ames, a tremendously valuable book, which I'm going to be giving to some of my relatives who could use it, who have children. And
yes, and I always say, if you've read the book, please, please write reviews on Amazon.
Very good.
And the website, if you go to my website, I have the podcasts. If a person clicks on podcasts, they're able to go through a number of topics. On any page, you go through, and I have 21 different topics that you can access information about via podcasts. I also have a newsletter tab, and I put out a monthly newsletter. Anyone, and of course, everything on my site is at no cost. The newsletters are, when a person signs up for a newsletter, they automatically get a complimentary newsletter, I don't know, a free gift, whatever, about financial information they need to know to raise a special needs kid. And on that newsletter, I have 10 podcast links of everything you need to know about raising special needs kids financially.
Is there help available? That's one question.
Yes. Yes.
There
good. Yes.
All right. And your podcasts are available everywhere where podcasts can be found, I imagine.
Yes.
All right.
So, yeah, everything. You can access everything at julieames.com. You can access it from the radio station, everywhere.
All right. Julie Clark Ames, thank you so much for being with us today. This was informative. The book is great. I recommend it for everyone. And thank you again for being with us.
All right. Thank you, Roger. Appreciate it.